From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Another shooting incident at a U.S. military base, this one taking the lives of four people, including the assailant who took his own life. We have this report from RT.
The soldiers opened fire at a U.S. military base in Texas, killing three people and himself. The gunman was an Iraq veteran and was treated for mental health issues. Officials say this had nothing to do with terrorism, though. Well, let's discuss this with Gordon Duff, editor of the Veterans Today newspaper. Now, firstly, this is not the first shooting at Fort Hood. Back in 2009, 13 people were killed then. Do you think this is a tragic coincidence, or do you think lessons should have been learned from that?
Well, there certainly were lessons. The last shooting was a psychiatrist at the base who'd been treating soldiers who'd returned from Iraq. This time it's a soldier that's returned from Iraq. Nearly 35% of the soldiers that are serving actively in the U.S. military are on antipsychotic medication. Those that are leaving the military, and as the wars are winding down, we're down to 30,000 troops in Afghanistan now. The military is downsizing, and these soldiers are all either looking forward to years of unemployment or are trying to position themselves as disabled veterans or in military retirement. And doing that has put them in an adversarial position with the military, has caused a tremendous amount of dissension, stress, suicides, and murder-suicide, as we're seeing now. This is only a guess. We have more to learn.
And do you think the government is doing enough to address the possible psychological problems that soldiers are facing?
Well, the government a few years ago opened a suicide hotline after over 20,000 veterans had killed themselves. As far as the military medical establishment, they're still pumping out dangerous medications, medications whose side effects, frankly, are known to be psychotic episodes, suicide. These medications are handed out piecemeal with very little accountability. And the military has still, despite the efforts to take care of veterans and those recently released, the military is still very much at war within itself and certainly resents. The military is showing signs of remorse for these recent wars, not remorse for what they've done, but remorse for having taken in so many people to fight these wars that they no longer need.
And with regard to security at U.S. facilities too, do you think that there's too much easy access to weapons there, considering what you've just said? Many people are returning from Iraq, suffering psychological problems, and many people who haven't actually returned from Iraq are suffering stress anyway.
Well, I'm retired military. I shop on a military base. It's not atypical for shoppers to pretty much largely be armed in the store. Military bases in themselves are dangerous. Sexual assaults on military bases are rampant. The military brought in, we'll say accidentally over the last few years, criminal organizations established themselves within the military. A military base is as dangerous an environment as some of America's worst cities.
Confirmation that the Palestinian Authority has, in fact, submitted applications to more than a dozen UN agencies as an independent state came Wednesday from Palestine's permanent observer to the United Nations. Jocelyn Sambira reports.
The Palestinian Authority has exercised its legal right in requesting to join a number of UN institutions. That's what Riyad Mansour, permanent observer of Palestine to the United Nations, told the press on Wednesday after he hand-delivered letters of accession to the Secretary General's chef de cabinet, Susan Malkora. Earlier, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas signed the 15 letters of accession to international instruments and conventions with the full backing of the members of the Palestinian Liberation Organization leadership. Ambassador Mansour said joining these institutions was in the national interest of the Palestinian people.
We are exercising our legal right as a state to join these instruments. We are part of humanity. This would allow us to shoulder our responsibility in carrying what is required from us under the provisions of these instruments. We are proud of that, and we consider the action by our president as a step to consolidate and strengthen the pillars of the state of Palestine in the international system.
Ambassador Mansour said the decision to submit the applications followed Israel's failure to deliver on its promise to release the fourth and last batch of 104 political prisoners jailed before the Oslo Accords. However, he insisted that the Palestinian leadership will continue with the U.S. brokered negotiations with Israel that resumed in July 2013. Jocelyn Sambira, United Nations.
A freak combination of weather conditions has left parts of England covered in a smog haze made up of high levels of particles, including red dust from a sandstorm in the Sahara. London and the south of England have been experiencing higher than normal levels of air pollution over the past week, with levels in the capital and southeast England rated at the maximum level of 10 Thursday, that according to the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. Emergency services have seen a surge in calls from people with breathing difficulties. Deborah Waddell, a clinician with the charity Asthma UK, spoke with Radio VR about the problem.
As the UK's leading asthma charity, we know that people with asthma tell us that around two-thirds of them have problems with their breathing and notice that their asthma symptoms are worse when the pollution levels are very high generally. So obviously when we're experiencing these current high levels of pollution impacted by the Saharan sand as well, it could cause added risk for asthma sufferers or for sufferers with any long-term lung condition.
There have been reports that there's been a rise in emergency calls, particularly people saying their breathing has been affected. Mm. Are you aware of that?
Yes, we are, and it is something we anticipated here at Asthma UK. We ran our own poll over the last 24 hours, and results of our poll show that around a third of people who responded have reported that they've had an asthma attack, and around over 80% of people with asthma who responded to our poll also said that they've been using their blue reliever inhaler more than usual. So I think it is affecting people. They are feeling their asthma symptoms over the last couple of days, and so I'm not surprised that, of course, people are worrying. We would encourage people, however, that there are measures they can take that to reduce their risk.
What sort of thing? Obviously, some people are on medication, but what else could someone do? Obviously, I believe you shouldn't exert yourself physically too much if you do have asthma.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. I think it's around knowing your asthma. Everybody's asthma is different, so it's about knowing your triggers, recognising your symptoms early enough. One of the things we do advise is that everybody with asthma should have an asthma action plan, which can actually be downloaded if you don't already have one from our website, www.asthma.org.uk. This action plan can help you to recognise your asthma symptoms in good time and to guide you into what action that you should take so that you can reduce your risk.
The official pollution warnings issued by the government, they say that London and the South East have been at level 10. For those of us who don't suffer from asthma, what does that mean? I mean, what sort of numbers would an asthma sufferer start to be cautious over?
Well, I think really any pollution, we know even when pollution levels can be very variable. So I think any exposure to pollution combined with these other extraordinary conditions at the moment are causing concern. But any level of pollution is a concern, especially long term. So I think really it's about people with asthma being aware of how they're affected. You know, pollution does cause asthma symptoms because obviously you're breathing in the particulates. The Saharan sand at the moment is quite a large particle, so it's very unlikely to go down into the small airways. But the atmospheric changes that it's causing mean that the small particles of pollution can get right down into the airways and make the airways very irritated. So really it's about people taking their preventer medications regularly as they've been prescribed, taking it correctly so that they know the medicine is getting right the way down into the airways. And I think most important of all, what we'd advise people at the moment with asthma is that they make sure that they carry a working blue reliever inhaler or a working reliever inhaler on them, you know, just to make sure that they're safe.
According to documents obtained by the Associated Press and multiple interviews with the people involved, the U.S. government, working through the U.S. Agency for International Development, planned to build a network of Twitter-style contacts in Cuba to incite protests intended to undermine the government there. Documents show the U.S. government planned to build a subscriber base by first offering what was described as, quote, non-controversial content, close quote, such as news messages on soccer games, music and the arts, and weather and hurricane updates. Later, when the network reached a critical mass of subscribers, the operators were to introduce political content aimed at inspiring Cubans to organize what it called smart mobs, mass gatherings called at a moment's notice that could trigger a Cuban spring, or, as one document put it, quote, renegotiate the balance of power between the state and society, closed quote. At its peak, the project drew in more than 40,000 Cubans to share news and exchange opinions, with subscribers unaware that it came from the U.S. government or the U.S. contractors were gathering their private data with the intent to use it for political purposes. According to a 2010 memo from Mobile Accord, one of the project's private contractors, quote, there will be absolutely no mention of United States government involvement. This is absolutely crucial for the long-term success of the service and to ensure the success of the mission, closed quote. The program's legality is unclear. U.S. law requires that any covert action by a federal agency must have a presidential authorization. USAID spokesperson Matt Herrick said that congressional investigators reviewed its Cuba programs last year and found them to be consistent with U.S. law. Another contractor involved in the project, Creative Associates, had acquired all of the cell phone numbers in Cuba. It envisioned using the list to create a social networking system to be called Project ZZ, marketed chiefly to young Cubans who USAID saw as the most open to political change. In one document, the U.S. government agency proposed to get involved gradually, advocating the use of what it called smart mobs, quote, only in critical, opportunistic situations and not at the detriment of our core platform-based network, closed quote. Apparently, there was a test conducted in September 2009 when thousands of Cubans gathered at Revolution Plaza in Havana for Colombian rocker Juanes' Peace Without Borders concert, the largest public gathering in Cuba since the visit of Pope John Paul II in 1998. The concert provided an opportunity to test the political power of their budding social network. In the weeks before the concert, using the phone list, the firm sent out a 500,000 text message blasts to measure what the Cuban government would do. The team hired Alan Lauzon Falcon, a Havana-born satirical artist based in Chile, to write Cuban-style messages. Some were mildly political and humorous, and others more pointed. One asked respondents whether they thought two popular local music acts out of favor with the government should join the stage with Juanes. Some 100,000 people responded, not realizing the poll was being used to gather critical intelligence. Paula Cambronero, a researcher for Mobile Accord, began building a vast database about the Cuban subscribers, including gender, age, what it called receptiveness, and political tendencies. USAID believed the demographics on descent could help it target its other Cuba programs and, quote, maximize our possibilities to extend our reach, closed quote. We'll have more on this tomorrow when we speak with our correspondent in Managua, Tony Solo. A bill in the U.S. House of Representatives would require the Obama administration to issue annual reports on the use of drone strikes, including figures of how many civilians were killed in those attacks. The bill, co-sponsored by Republican Walter Jones of North Carolina and Democrat Adam Schiff of California, is called the Targeted Lethal Force Transparency Act. Though the president has repeatedly promised overhauls and transparency measures on the drone programs, Congress has remained largely in the dark about who is being killed and why. Representative Jones said this move would be the first step towards serious congressional oversight of the drone program. The two members face an uphill battle. Mikhail Zenko, an official with the Council on Foreign Relations, said he doesn't see any way the bill can pass because, quote, these are CIA operations that are covert by definition, closed quote. Representative Schiff noted the drone strikes are only classified because the president makes them so and insisted that the reports from the bill would not require identification of those conducting the strikes or the specifics of any individual incident, but rather seeks a raw count of who is killed every year. The bill explicitly rules out drone strikes used in ongoing wars and would report only those in nations where the U.S. isn't engaged in official military operations. Meanwhile, organizing against the robo killings is being stepped up across the country. On Wednesday, a live program and international webcast in support of the Spring Days of Action 2014, a coordinated campaign in April and May to end drone killing, drone surveillance, and global militarization, took place at the Community Church in Manhattan. Deb Sweet is executive director of World Can't Wait, one of the groups which organized the campaign.
An interesting program called Drones and Dirty Wars, and it's a orientation training prelude to 2 months of protests of the U.S. drone wars and surveillance, which actually started yesterday at Beale Air Force Base in California and at another Air Force base near Niagara Falls, New York, and is spreading across the country at Air Force bases where drones are remotely piloted, at universities and in communities, schools, and so forth, where hundreds of activists from around the country are spreading out to protest and do public outreach about the U.S. drone war.
Let's give listeners an overview of exactly what the U.S. is doing with these drones.
Well, you know, it's really difficult to tell because these programs have been secret. There's a CIA program and there's a U.S. military program. It's all been the subject of a lot of controversy internationally because the program, which really got amped up after Obama took power in 2009, has probably killed 4,000-some people, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. The U.S. refuses to release any statistics and says that these are very carefully, narrowly targeted strikes. But we know, for instance, there have been up to 50 or 60 people killed in the strikes, and have documentation that hundreds of them have been children. The countries most heavily targeted have been Pakistan, Yemen. Also, they've gone into Somalia with drones, and Mali, and it's really a burgeoning technology, so it's difficult to know all of where the U.S. is going with surveillance drones, and we know they've used weaponized drones also in Iraq and Afghanistan.
So, and they're also establishing bases around Africa for these, right?
Yeah, I mean, the thing about drones is they can be piloted from halfway around the world. A lot of the drones in Afghanistan are piloted from Hancock Air Force Base in Syracuse, New York, for instance.
Hmm.
And it's remote technology, so it's, you know, pilots and operators looking at computer screens and sometimes following their targets around for weeks.
Hmm.
And creating a huge amount of stress, just like the Israelis do with drones over Gaza and the West Bank. These drones can fly overhead for weeks, and then suddenly Hellfire missiles are used to obliterate the target. Now, there's no defense against these missiles because you can't possibly personally in a house build enough of a bunker to survive that kind of a missile attack. And a lot of the missiles are directed at people in cars or walking, sometimes playing soccer. It's really chilling, and it is just an expression of one more length that the United States has gone to project its occupation into places where, you know, they have been militarized.
Carl Dix from Stop Stop in Frisco, New York, pointed to the similarities between U.S. drone use abroad and police terror at home.
I need you all to imagine something with me. Let's imagine that we're in the Waziristan area of Pakistan. We are friends and family of a couple that has just gotten married. We are celebrating this joyous occasion. Then all of a sudden, there comes out of the sky a missile. It explodes. It levels the village that we're celebrating in. A number of us are killed. Most of the rest of us are wounded. The joyous occasion has turned to grief and outrage. And then there is a report in the media of record in the imperialist countries around the world, and that report is that insurgents and combatants were gathering, doubtlessly plotting some nefarious activity, but they were foiled in that by the U.S. military. That is how this would come down. Now, I asked you to imagine this, but unfortunately, we don't have to imagine things like this happening. Because since 2002, there have been hundreds of drone missile strikes in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, Somalia, and maybe in some other countries that they haven't been exposed yet, and thousands of people have died. So unfortunately, this is not an imaginary thing, but a very real thing. Now, the U.S. has an explanation for all of this. They say these drone missile strikes are necessary, legal, and just. That's a quote. Obama said in May of last year, terrorists who pose a continuing and imminent threat to the American people are who we're striking. And that before any strike is taken, there must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured. And then because of this stringent criteria, Obama claims that very, very few non-terrorist civilians have been killed in drone strikes. According to him, these actions are effective, and simply put, they have saved lives. This is just a big fat lie. But look, here's how they get away with saying this BS. They have classified every male of military age as an insurgent or a combatant. So that if they kill anybody, the males that they kill were the enemy. And any women and children who get killed, well, that's because those enemies were hiding among those women and children. So by definition, anybody that they kill is an enemy or somebody collected by the enemy to try to protect them against what the U.S. is doing. This is what we're dealing with when we talk about the U.S. and drone missile strikes. And what makes wedding parties so often a target is that they are gatherings of people. Because what it is the people in that area are all fair game for the U.S. military. And whenever they gather, it is a legitimate military target to be gone at and taken out. Now, some people would say, like, okay, this is bad, and it has nothing to do with what America is all about. Well, no, it has everything to do with what America is all about. And to get at that, let me tell you about another wedding. Let me tell you about the wedding that a young man named Sean Bell was going to have November 25th of 2006. He was going to get married to Nicole Paltry, his longtime girlfriend, the mother of his child. He was at a bachelor party a few hours before the wedding. Undercover cops claim they heard someone say something about a gun. They surround the car that Sean and a couple of his friends were riding in, fire 50 shots into it, murdering Sean Bell and severely wounding two of his friends. Now, what does this have to do with the earlier wedding? What it sprang from was just like what those other wedding parties that got hit by drone missile strikes sprang from. And that's the criminalization of whole peoples. Because what we're dealing with in the murder of Sean Bell and the police murder of many, many other people, mostly young, mostly black and Latino, is that those are people who have been criminalized by this society. just like military-age males in Waziristan, in places in Afghanistan and other places, have been criminalized. And they are fair game. We see this happening again and again and again with police who murder people outright and then get away scot-free, are not punished in any way. We see this escalating to the point where now it is even beyond the police in this country. Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, both murdered by racists, neither of which got convicted of murder. And then we have the case of Renisha McBride, a young black woman who was gunned down looking for help after an accident by a white homeowner. So it's not even just men. But this is what we're talking about, the criminalization of whole sections of people. It is outrageous and unacceptable that whole sections of people can be criminalized, made fair game for murder, whether by the military, by in other parts of the world, or by police and racist vigilantes here in the U.S., for the maintenance of, on the one hand, the U.S.'s far-flung global empire, and on the other hand, for the stability in the homeland of that, through the suppression of black and Latino people, whose response to the miserable conditions that are enforced on them is something that this government fears, just like they fear what those young people in other parts of the world will do. And it is very, very important that both of these be met with determined resistance.
After the event, Press TV spoke with Eric Dreitzer, the senior editor of the website StopImperialism.org.
Now, this obviously, this campaign brings into question the widespread practice of drone warfare by the U.S. And it hones in on the issue of, as one of the campaigners pointed out, about who is being killed and for what.
Yes, indeed. And I think that this is an important point to make, not only who are the victims of the drone attacks, but what is the purpose, what is the function of the drone in the modern military machine that is the United States and its military apparatus. Remember that the drones only they serve many different functions. On the one hand, they serve a function on the battlefield, whether the United States has chosen to define its battlefield as Afghanistan in a war or as a quote-unquote operation in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, or elsewhere. This is a fundamental part of the drone strategy, but the drone strategy is much more than that. Remember that it is a part of U.S. power projection. We can see that the United States is building drone bases all over the world in places like Niger in Africa, in places in Diego Garcia, the U.S. military base there, in the Middle East, and all over the world. The drones are a part of the U.S. military apparatus, military power projection that doesn't require the stationing of troops. It doesn't require permanent military bases or anything like that. So it is a transformation of the way in which the United States projects its military power. And this is fundamental in the 21st century as the United States and its imperial presence has come under increasing scrutiny.
Indeed, as you pointed out, this drone warfare is sort of an evolution of America's policies, militarily speaking. But should we consider that the drones are here to stay, or will campaigns such as this one and others that are being started in different parts of the world curb this practice, so to speak?
Well, what these sorts of campaigns can do is they can shine a light of public attention on this issue, an issue which in many ways operates in the shadows, particularly, of course, in the shadows of the public consciousness. But I do think, and I don't mean to sound overly pessimistic, but the amount of money and time and energy and technology that has been invested in the drones is not simply going to be undone by one campaign or two or even a sustained campaign. Rather, there needs to be a groundswell of popular support, both in the United States and around the world, a true coalition, a true movement of the people against not only drones, but against this form of militarization, the permanent militarization of U.S. foreign policy. This is the fundamental point.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.